terrible tease. Did you hear those whispers in the trees? The whispers of a tale only known to very few. I could tell you if you want me to. Once upon a time, in the aftermath of war, something happened here no one had ever seen before. Something so miraculous, something so unique. They struck it from the guidebooks. They don't want to seem like freaks. Step into the tale of Baltimore. Two or three, don't believe me. I will show you. Let me see.
Welcome to the Broadway Radio Show. I'm Donald Feltham, and I am thrilled and delighted to have two very special guests on this episode. We have an award-winning playwright and screenwriter, Nancy Harris. Hi, Nancy.
Hi. Great to be here.
And an award-winning composer of musicals and scores for theater, film, and animation, Mr. Mark Teitler. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Donald.
Great to have you both here. And they're here because they have written a musical called The Magician's Elephant. And the cast recording for that musical is now out on Center Stage Records. It just came out. Nancy wrote the book and lyrics, and Mark wrote music and lyrics for the show. Congratulations on the new cast recording. It's a wonderful, wonderful cast recording, which we will dive into as we go along here. Hopefully this will spur some new productions of the show. We're going to get into the history of the show shortly. But first, how did this adaptation, it's based on a book, it's based on a young adult book by Kate DiCamillo. How did this adaptation come about? Where did this inspiration of turning the book into a musical come from?
A London bookshop. I was in a London bookshop and found the book. I found myself gravitating towards it. Mm-hmm. And I picked it up and read it. At that time, Nancy and I, we'd already made a musical together called Baddies. And we were keen to do something that felt like it could be pretty much through scored, or not entirely through sung, but mostly. And when I read the book, I mean, there are lots of things that I fell in love with instantly in the book. But one of the things was the scope of it and the characters. And so I had an instinct that it might be of interest to Nancy. And that was the beginning of the journey.
Mm-hmm. And Nancy, I'm assuming you then read the book, right?
Yeah. I mean, Mark and I, my discipline is a playwright, and Mark is a composer, and obviously. And so I had never written musicals before until I met Mark. And our first musical was this show, Baddies. So that was kind of our learning curve, if you like. And I guess how you've described it always, Mark, is kind of like a cabaret musical. It was about the villains of fairy tales who are locked up by the goodies of fairy tales and rebranded. And so we had a lot of fun with that. And we'd had a great response. The show had been kind of a hit and came back again and stuff. So we were kind of galvanized, but we sort of wanted to challenge ourselves to do something bigger. And Kate DiCamillo's book it's sort of like an impossible book in a way to stage. And that's what made it so completely compelling to us to actually give it a go and try to make it into a musical.
Right. And it's a book that's geared, I guess you could say it's geared kind of to, I wouldn't know if I would call it a children's book or a young adult's book. It's kind of a book because it's got a lot of really interesting, heavy themes in it. And some kind of dark aspects to it. And I'm guessing that must have appealed to you as well, right?
It definitely appealed to both of us. I mean, I think you're absolutely spot on. I think what both Mark and I gravitate to in Kate is the fact that she is so, does not patronize her audience. Like the story is tough and there's grief in there and there's loss as well as joy and exuberance. But she's not afraid to go there. Mm-hmm. And that was what we had learned on Baddies. We were learned if you start giving saccharine things, the kids can smell it a mile away. Whereas they're a natural anarchy of childhood and children actually appeals to a certain kind of darkness. And Mark and I both loved that about Baddies, and that's what we really, that's what drew us to the book, isn't it, Mark?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I think we found as well from our experience of Baddies, in fact, it's quite often children are a tougher audience than adults when it comes to being able, well, and also very capable of taking on complexity. So it's why I think this book is a little bit like The Little Prince. I'm not quite sure what other comparison there is. You know, on the surface, someone might read it and think it's young adult or for children, but it feels fairly universal.
Mm-hmm. So what can you give the listeners, sort of a brief synopsis of the story and the characters without giving too much away? But because it is a relatively, it's not a real simple story in a lot of ways. There's a lot of layers to it. So can you give kind of a quick synopsis of it?
People say, give us the elevator pitch. And then 4.5 hours later, I think it's going to be really frank.
Well, it can't be a real quick pitch, really. When I started reading it, I went, oh, wow, there's a lot of different things going on in this.
Yeah, we've tried. And, you know, I'm an Irish playwright, so we're not known for our short. But I'll give you the best shot. You're spot on. It was really challenging to adapt this, to simplify it without taking away the magic of Kate's work. But in essence, it's about a town called Baltese, which is a sort of a fictional kind of fairy tale town somewhere in Europe, somewhere in the last century, or maybe the century before last. It's just recovered from a great war. And also Mark and I, we always thought it was kind of Eastern Europe. But anyway, it's just come out of a great war. And the town, people have lost family, people have lost, you know, a lot. They've lost jobs, everything. And the central character is a young boy who's been orphaned and is being looked after by an old soldier who's got post-traumatic stress disorder. And the soldier is absolutely not cut out to be a father. He sort of makes the boy do military maneuvers, all this kind of stuff. And the boy is kind of a slightly cowed by this. And every day he goes to the market to buy bread and fish for this guardian. And one day he goes into the market square, and it's a very grey, dark market square. Everybody does the same thing every day. And there's this incredibly beautiful, dazzling fortune teller's tent. And the boy has been having these dreams that he can hear a baby crying. And he's convinced it's his sister, who he was told died at childbirth. So he goes in and he asks the fortune teller about his sister. And the fortune teller says his sister is alive. And the boy is totally shocked because he's always been told she died at childbirth. And he's like, well, how do I find her? And the fortune teller says, follow the elephant.
What is that? Don't any of you see it? Where did it come from? What's it doing here? Why? Whoa. What does it... The most profound and difficult... Question.
The most profound and difficult questions will be answered within for the price of one floret.
Did they just say I could ask a question?
The most profound and difficult questions.
For the price of one floret?
One floret.
I have one floret. And I have a profound and difficult question. No, it's stupid. If I come home without food, Vilna Lutz will ask where the money's gone and I'll have to lie.
The most profound and difficult questions.
And Vilna says lying is the most dishonorable thing a soldier can do.
Will be answered within.
I was sent here to buy bread and fish, so I will buy bread and fish.
For the price of one floret.
But what if they could really tell me? Excuse me? Hello?
Yes.
I have a question.
A profound and a difficult question.
I believe so, yes.
Very well then. Come closer, boy. Give me your hand. Very interesting.
What are you seeing?
One floret will buy you one answer. And one answer only. Understand?
Yes.
Speak then. Ask.
My parents.
That's your question? Your parents are dead.
That's not my question. I know my parents are dead. I've known that for years. I have another question. See, I've been having this dream where I can hear a baby crying, and I...
Ah, your sister.
Yes. How did you... I think that's her in my dream. But she's dead, so...
Nah, she lives!
She what? She lives! My sister lives!
Thank you, Cole.
No, please. What do you mean she lives? Vilna Lutz told me she died with my mother.
Oh, he did tell you that, didn't he? Poor boy.
So it's not true.
You have asked your question.
No, that wasn't my question.
Ah, careful. I'm only giving you one more chance. What is your question?
My question is, how do I find her? How do I find my sister?
The elephant.
Sorry?
Follow the elephant.
She will lead you.
What elephant?
That's a third question.
There are no elephants in Baltese. It's cold here, it's gray, the sky is always dark. It hasn't even snowed for over 100 years.
That is true. That is definitely true. At least for now. But perhaps you are beginning to notice, Peter Duchene. The truth is forever changing. You can go now. But don't let the draft in, will you? It's bloody freezing in here.
And there's no elephants in this town. The boy's like, well, that was a waste of money. I was lied to. He leaves, devastated. Cross the town in another milieu in an opera house where all the posh people of the town are gathered. A magician having an existential crisis that his life has come to nothing decides to summon an elephant, say the spell for an elephant. So an elephant comes crashing through the roof of the opera house, crushes a noblewoman's legs, sends the whole town into a frenzy. As no one's ever seen an elephant, they don't know what to do with it. And suddenly the elephant becomes this kind of symbol for the town of hope and possibility and magic, and maybe their lives don't have to be so awful. And this is, so there's a lot of different characters, but essentially the elephant, the town go wild over this elephant, and the boy finds the elephant. He thinks the elephant's going to lead him to his sister. And actually what he realizes when he comes face to face with the elephant is the elephant's dying, needs to go back home. But by that point, the town are so invested in what the elephant can do for them that they don't want to. So it becomes this story of kind of individual versus the community versus doing the right thing, letting go of what we think we want in order to get what we need. That's the elevator pitch.
Right. But I mean, even just from that, you can tell that there's a lot of interesting themes and characters in there. And you've got a really complex central character in the boy, because which is not typical of a lot of these. I mean, in a lot of these young adult or children focused books, you oftentimes have a young boy or girl, and they generally have one goal or one driving thing in their life. And it's, you know, the story is basically how they're going to get there and the obstacles in their way. And in this, there's a lot more issues involved here and a lot more things going on. So talk about in general, for not only for this show, I mean, this is obviously quite different than Baddies in terms of what you're doing. Because as you said, Baddies was sort of a cabaret-ish type show. Talk about your collaborative process, the two of you. Is it a situation where Nancy sits down and writes the libretto, the book first, and then you sit down and pick out where we're going to put songs? Or have the songs already started and you've already started writing songs, you know, at the beginning because you just feel that there's a need there? Because having myself written some librettos for shows, you know, every writing team has a little bit of a different process. What is the process with you two?
I mean, I think it's I don't know if you recall it in the same way, Nancy, but I think it was slightly different from Baddies to The Magician's Elephant. For The Magician's Elephant, I think it was a bit of all of that. I think there were moments when I had very clear ideas about musical themes. Uh-huh. I mean, I think from the beginning, I think from first reading the book, I had a sense of, I had sort of fragments came to me of possible ideas linked to particular characters. And in the score, there is that sense of particular characters having particular themes connected with them. So there was a bit of that. There was a lot of it was Nancy and I sitting down and working out how to adapt the book, writing out treatments and working out where songs needed to happen. And, you know, songs are often a heat map. I sort of feel that if you can't think of a song for a particular moment, it might be that there is something wrong in the moment. Mm-hmm. There is something dramatic about it. So we spent quite a bit of time working that out. But I think there's only, I personally find there's only so far you can go with that without actually writing. I mean, you can't do the whole thing cold on treatment. You have to, and so there's elements of Nancy writing lyrics and giving them to me and me trying them. I had a go at writing lyrics. I think we were talking about this the other day, that writing the moment when the town go absolutely wild over the appearance of the elephant and they start to try and monetize the elephant. What are they selling, Nancy? They're selling
They're changing the name of catfish to elephant fish. They're selling pastries that are called elephant ears. You know, they're doing roofs that are elephant proof.
So there was that. So I think I had a go at writing lyrics for that. I already had snatches of melody. Nancy had gave me lyrics for If This Is True, which is a song in which after meeting the fortune teller, Peter has a sort of existential crisis, because on the one hand, he's desperate for it to be true that his sister lives. But on the other hand, his guardian had told him all his life that that's not the case, which poses the question of whether he can trust his guardian. And I think Nancy also wrote a really beautiful set of lyrics for What If, Why Not, Could It Be, which is the dream, which is a policeman Leo Mattien's song about what it says about the nature of the universe, that an elephant has come crashing through the roof, and what else might... All the possible things that might happen as a result of that.
But what if it is true? What if it is magic? What if she's just the first in a series of elephants to arrive in Baltese? What if, one by one, all the mammals and reptiles of Africa were to be summoned to opera houses all over Europe? What if, next week, giraffes and crocodiles and rhinoceroses came crashing through roofs? What if...
Why not?
Could it be? An elephant lands in Baltese. What in the world can it mean? Is she the first to fall to the earth? And where will the next one be seen? Will there be pythons in Paris? Or rhinoceri running round Rome? Or penguins in Cairo? Flamingos in Florence making their home in the dome? What if, why not, could it be that things are not just what we see? Is there more to the skies than we see with our eyes? And where does that leave you and me? Could there be lemmings in Lima? Orangutans swinging in crew? Will there be sharks taking over our parks? Or dolphins in handbags and shoes? Will there be badgers in Boston riding on bikes to the beach? Seals sailing boats or articulate stoats? None of it seems out of reach. What if, why not, could it be that things are not just what they seem? Is there more to the skies than we see with our eyes? And where does that leave you and me? In Baltese, what in the world can it mean? Is she the first to fall to the earth? And where will the next one be seen?
Private Duchesne, time for maneuvers. Forward march. Left.
Peter.
Left.
Psst. Peter.
Left, right.
Little
left.
Cuckoo bird of the attic world. You'll never guess what's just happened. Peter!
Leo Mattien, are you trying to wake the entire street up?
Gloria, oh, Gloria, it's the most exciting, incredible thing.
What are you...
Do you believe in magic, Gloria?
Magic?
I think I do. I think after tonight, I definitely do.
What are you on about?
An elephant lands in Baltese.
Elephant?
What elephant?
I asked myself, what could it mean?
What are you talking about, Liam Etienne?
The impossible happened! The impossible happened.
Oh, no. You're not going to start.
Which means that for you and me...
Stop. I know where this is going.
But maybe there's still a chance.
There's no chance. The doctor said...
What if we keep trying?
My heart's broken from trying, Leo.
What if, why not, could it be that things are not just what they seem? Maybe there's more to our lives. We can still be surprised.
I think it changes. I think every team finds that each project sometimes requires a different approach because of the nature of the material.
I think that's right. Because Baddies, we basically did the script first and then slotted songs. And we absolutely, because we had a book to work from, we did have to do, as Mark says, treatments and structures. But I was quite keen that the music, that I wasn't just offering script, song, that actually the music was sort of in, was threaded through it, which meant that actually when I was writing scenes, they were almost to be set to music. It's almost completely sung through.
Mm-hmm.
So we, in a way, that we kind of wrote it as it went along. The music and the lyrics went hand in hand, I would say, on this.
I want to talk about the score because in terms of the musical influences for the score, because as you said, it's you find yourself a little bit of freedom in the sense that it's a fairy tale village that's set in a fictional country, fictional you don't have a specific location or a specific time. You know it's sort of possibly Eastern Europe, possibly sometime in the 19th century. And it's sort of like an indeterminate time period and place. So you have a little bit of musical freedom, but at the same time, you're dealing with a modern audience and you still need it to feel a little bit of it being not modern day. It still has to have some sort of vintage feel to it. And do you understand what I'm saying? You have some constriction on yourself, but you still have freedom in the sense that you have a fictional fairy tale setting, but at the same time, you can't make it 100% modern. So what were the kind of the influences in terms of the music and then also the lyrics?
Yeah, I mean, it's a really good observation. I think, as you say, we didn't set out to do anything faithful to a period because it feels like it's an adjacent reality.
Mm-hmm.
So I think we sort of took the approach of trying to draw on the things that naturally appeal to us, you know, in this sort of late 19th century romanticism. There's a little bit of that musically.
Mm-hmm.
I would say there's a little bit of John Williams in the score as well, because there's an E.T. quality to the story as well, and the relationship between Peter and the elephant. There's a bit of Danny Elfman. Again, I think Tim Burton's sort of a reference because he does that thing that you just described very well, where even if he's in the 50s, there'll be a sprinkle of the 50s, but it nevertheless always feels very contemporary. Mm-hmm. And I think it does feel... I think it does feel contemporary. There's a little bit of Disney in the score. I'm a big fan of Ella Menken. I think that's found its way in it. A bit of Tom Waits. So I don't know if that answers your question or not.
Yeah. No, it does. It does.
I think it's more like we sort of channel the things that interest in this period, but without ever trying to pastiche it or be faithful to it, just to sort of and give a little bit of a hint of it, I think is always enough.
Right. Well, and like I said, it because of the source material, it gives you the freedom to do that.
Yeah.
You know, you're not pigeonholed into, I have to be true to a specific, like it's not Vienna in 1800 and something. So I don't have to be, you know, stick in a Viennese waltz to make it work. I can literally stretch a little bit and pull from different styles and make it unique and make it its own.
One of the other things that I was interested in was the way in which elephants communicate with each other. And I spent a lot of time listening to recordings of elephant communication, and I found a way of, because I wanted each character to have their own language, including the elephant. Because a lot of the time, there is an element of, in the story of how we mistreat animals, there's an animal exploitation element in it. And I wanted to avoid this sort of easy, we're not doing a talking elephant here. I wanted to try and find through music the internal world of the elephant. And so I spend a lot of time listening to elephant communication, and it's there in the score.
Right.
So, I mean, that was important to you, right, Mark, that you didn't want it to be like a children's show in a talking elephant. You were like, and opera was quite influential to you as well in the score.
I think so, yeah. I think in answer to your question, to Donald's question about sort of the influence, I think there's a bit of Verdi in there.
And it does have that feel to it. You can definitely sense that in the score when you listen to it.
What is going on down there? They're not still talking about that blasted elephant.
It has quite captured the public imagination, dear.
Why?
You weren't there to see it appear. It was quite astonishing.
I don't care. No one is talking about me anymore.
No, dear.
You wouldn't understand. You were never charismatic. But me... I used to be a someone who everyone revered. A party only started when I quintet appeared. From the unimportant riffraff and the lowly hoi polloi to aristocrats and royalty, my name would bring such joy.
So true.
But... now it seems I'm nothing. A mere has-been in this town, replaced by an elephant. They treat me like a clown.
You're not a clown.
Levon's become a cripple and sealed her growing fame. And I'm just able-bodied. They've forgotten my good name. Never before has my whole life been under such grave threat. My popularity's in danger, my entire raison d'etre. Elephant this, elephant that, this whole town's blown its top. We cannot let this carry on. Do something, make it stop.
My dazzling princess, my vintage car, my lollipop, my superstar. The words you speak, the clothes you wear, no one has your class or flair.
I know that.
But the world has changed, and so must we. The old ways have become our enemy. With a small adjustment of your brand, you'll be the talk of all the land.
How?
What I'm trying to say, my little petal, this whole affair is fate. The key to their attention is the elephant you hate.
The elephant!
We need to think outside the box or make a box of our own and put that creature on display. Surely it deserves a home.
A home, yes!
The great and good will flock to see the colossus in your care. What better way to guarantee your name gets everywhere? Show the world the side of you it rarely gets to see. Kindness, heart, compassion, love, and selfless charity.
Charity! Yes!
Follow, follow, follow the elephant will show us the way.
Follow, follow, follow the elephant will show me the way.
Follow, follow, follow the elephant will light up your name.
Follow, follow, follow the elephant will bring back my fame.
Follow, follow, follow
the elephant will do as I say.
Follow, follow, follow the elephant.
We cannot wait another day, no time to waste, we can't delay. Arrange the purchase right away.
talk a little bit about the development, because once the show was finished, obviously, if I read correctly, you did do some workshops of it, right?
The show went on at the Royal Shakespeare Company in 2021, but it, I mean, we started working on it in 2016, 2017. So it was like a 4 or 5 year process, really. And we had a couple of workshops. Our first big workshop had quite a few fun musical stars in it, like, you know, we had Victoria Hamilton Barrett and Paul Mescal. You know Paul Mescal from Normal People? He was in our first workshop because Mark and I have worked with him before. So we had, and Jack Wolf, and we had a great company of people who kind of sang through the first act for us. And we showed that to the Royal Shakespeare Company and they really liked it. So then we kept going. And then we were on during COVID. And that was pretty challenging because it's a big show, right, Mark? It's like there's massive music, huge cast, a huge puppet elephant made by Mervyn Miller. And we were still in kind of social distancing times where there was literally somebody in the room standing with a ruler that people couldn't stand 2 meters. So it was probably the most stressful conditions under which to try and make a joyful musical. But in a way, it sort of taught us a huge amount. And then after the show finished at the Royal Shakespeare Company, there was going to be another production quite soon afterwards in Utah at the Hale Center Theater, which is where this album is from. And so Mark and I were able to kind of make some changes and some adjustments between the two productions. And that's the album that you hear, essentially. Right.
And I wanted to talk a little bit about the Royal Shakespeare production because I recommend people take a look at some of the videos that are posted on YouTube. Because I looked at many of those because it really does reflect the challenges of coming out of the pandemic. It's actually quite moving because it was really at a moment when people were just finally creative people, the creators were finally being able to get into rooms together. With limitations, but being able to get into rooms together to put shows like this together under some restrictions. But it's a really wonderful document of the time of trying to get this show together right after the pandemic is finally starting to ease up. And you can see the team, the director and the cast and everyone trying to get this show on its feet. And it's a real testament to the fact that even with the pandemic, the creativity was not snuffed out. You know, I mean, the creative fires were still burning and it was now finally time to, you know, unveil the creative things that had been bubbling under the surface during pandemic.
Yeah, I mean, it did its full run, I think. Mm-hmm. It was on for 3 or 4 months. I think, Nancy, we had our full cast for only around 10 or 11 performances or 12 or something around that. So
yeah, it was the time when every single show on the West End was like closing down. It was like so everything opened up and then everything closed down again because when anyone got COVID, the show had to close.
Right. New York was like that also. It was very similar. Things were opening and then somebody would get sick and then they would have to close down again and take a hiatus and then until people were healthy again and then got reopened. It was a nightmare.
Our point of pride was that we didn't shut down, but we had like 8 understudies or something. And one night, all of them were on.
Ugh.
They were sometimes playing 2 or 3 different people that they hadn't been playing before. It was wild. I mean, you could probably publish our show reports as a special document of the pandemic. Yeah. So, but you know, as you say, the thing about the cast is they didn't want to not go on. They would I think Jack Wolf went on nearly every performance. I think he did actually get sick right at the end. Did he, Mark, or am I just misremembering that?
I think you're right. I think he did nearly all the performances until the very end.
Like he wanted to, they all wanted to. And they loved the show, but it's not an easy show at the best of times, but a really difficult show in a pandemic.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And I'm also curious, I meant to ask, has Kate seen the show? Has Kate been involved at all? Did you consult with her when you were doing any creating on the show?
Yeah, we met her early on in the process. Mm-hmm. She is so delightful, isn't she, Mark? She's like, she couldn't have been more supportive. She kept saying to us, like, this is your, just take it, do what you need to do, which of course is what that does, is it makes you incredibly loyal and want to do exactly what, you know, we wanted to do her book justice. Mm-hmm. And the complexity of the story she's trying to tell justice, which is difficult because it's panoramic and it's about a community and it's about a community coming together, you know, and realizing their humanity. So, but she was wonderful, but she couldn't come because of the pandemic. You know, she wasn't able to fly. So she has heard the music. She's been totally supportive of the show. But yeah, that was another kind of sadness for us. We would have loved her to have been there.
So talk about some of the changes between the Royal Shakespeare Company production and ultimately the Hale Center production in Utah. I know you said you had a chance to make some changes. I know the looks of the show are different. The productions look a little bit different. I know the elephant looks substantially different in both productions, but because obviously you have a different creative team working on two different productions. But what did you learn from London in terms of the reception from the audience? And because I know how it is, once you get a show on stage in front of an audience, you learn a lot of things that you want to, you know, invest in the next production. So what were some of the things you learned to implement when you got to Utah?
Well, I would say one of the big things was the opening number, because as it's an ensemble drama, and as Nancy mm-hmm. said, it's quite panoramic, you have to honor the spirit of that. You have to, you can't dumb it down and cut out characters and so on. But at the same time, it makes it extremely important that the opening number allows you to have a sense of who the characters are, but also we wanted to make something that was more Peter-centric, because in the previous version, it gave us we sort of got a sense of what the town was like, what the dilemma was, the fact that the opening number is discipline, control, routine. It still is. But in the rewrite, we wanted to make sure that Peter was threaded right throughout the song, so that when he finally arrives at the fortune teller's tent, we really get a sense of how high stakes and how much of an act of defiance it is for him to go in and spend the money he's been given to pay for food mm-hmm. On a fortune teller. Is that how you remember? And I think there was another moment where we wrote a couple of new songs as well.
We had a song. Yeah, we had a song that actually worked quite well in the Royal Shakespeare Company version, but we felt it wasn't quite threading the narrative strong enough. And so it was sung by the police chief. And so we went back and we rewrote another song called Your Mind's Playing Tricks on You, which we both, it works a lot better. And it kind of is a great song, but it also, it gives us action. And yeah, that was a kind of a decision we made. And we also shortened our opening number, Welcome to Baltese. We had Welcome to Baltese moves into Discipline, Control, Routine. And Welcome to Baltese is kind of the fairy tale world being conjured, and Mark's music is really evocative. And then Discipline, Control, Routine, I think it's been compared to Kurt Vile or something, hasn't it, Mark? It's much tougher. Mm-hmm. And we felt like we needed, so we shortened the fairy tale stuff, and we kind of lengthened the tough stuff, but we, in a way, you know yourself, it can sometimes actually, when you shorten something, it can make it feel more profound or more pointed. I think in a way it works better, Welcome to Baltese, as a shorter song.
That's right. And we also, we wanted more of Peter throughout the act. There were moments when we just realized we were losing sight of the protagonist. And so Your Mind's Playing Tricks was that previously was a song sung by the police chief about how they were going to lock up the elephant, and it was fun. The audience liked it, but we realized that we were losing something by not having Peter in that song.
Whereas now it's a small boy seeing an elephant and a bunch of adults telling him he's not seeing an elephant. His mind's playing tricks on him, and that's quite a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun staging wise of basically a young boy being gaslit by the police chief trying to cover his track.
When you start seeing things that others don't see, when the pictures in your head are getting stranger, if you're talking to ghosts
or little men in the trees,
you know that your sanity's in danger. When you start hearing things that others can't hear,
dark whispers,
or crying or a shrieking,
it's time to call a doctor.
Call the men in white coats, 'cause your sanity is taking a beating.
That's your mind playing tricks, and it's doing it for kicks. It's the kind of thing a man mind likes to do. Your mind's playing tricks,
and there's no easy fix.
When your mind's playing tricks,
your mind's playing tricks,
your mind's playing tricks on you.
Look! It knocked over that flower pot.
What flower pot?
Don't see a flower pot.
Really?
I think he's really losing it, Chief.
When things start to move that no one else sees move.
When objects start floating through the air.
That's the time to panic.
There's no time to lose. Your sanity is hanging by a hair.
When you're hearing dustbins talk.
Or statues start to walk.
When a painting comes to life within its frame. I'm afraid you've lost your grip.
You're going cuckoo loop the loop.
Soon you won't even know your own name. That's your mind playing tricks, and it's doing it for kicks. It's the kind of thing a mad mind likes to do.
Your mind's playing tricks, and there's no easy fix.
When your mind's playing tricks,
your mind's playing tricks,
your mind's playing tricks on you.
So you're saying that that isn't there?
I'm the chief of police, and I know what's what. I know when something's there, and when it's not. I keep Baltis clean, I keep Baltis straight. That's why the people here think I'm so great. The great police chief, the great police chief.
Getting a bit off topic here, Chief.
You're right. Where were we? Oh, yes. That's your mind playing tricks, and it's doing it for kicks. It's the kind of thing a mad mind likes to do. Your sanity's gone AWOL. Your sanity won't play ball, and all the time your thoughts are mocking you.
Your mind's playing
your
tricks,
mind's playing
and it's
tricks.
Doing it for kicks.
Doing it for
it's the kind
kicks.
Of thing a mad mind likes to do.
Is it really playing tricks?
Yes, it's definitely playing tricks.
That's how it gets its crazy kicks. Your mind's playing
my
tricks.
Mind's playing
your
tricks.
Mind's playing
my
tricks.
Mind's playing
your
tricks.
Mind's playing tricks on you.
That has been the challenge throughout, was kind of defining like Peter as the central protagonist and then four or five key people like the Count and Countess who are sort of the antagonists who take the elephant and lock it up. And, you know, it was just trying to kind of give everything the right balance. That was really our biggest challenge.
Did you notice a difference in terms of audiences? And between the London audience, the UK audience at Royal Shakespeare versus the Utah audiences in terms of how they reacted to the show. Because I would think some of the themes and some of the story plot elements might hit people differently in England as opposed to the US. Did you notice any differences between the audiences?
Which bit did you think would hit them differently?
I think that setting it in sort of a war-torn recovering village strikes people a little bit differently, because I know England has been through actual being hit by war-torn stuff much more than the U.S. has. You know, England has gone through being bombed during World War II, and the U.S. has never really been through that kind of that history and having that kind of legacy. And I don't think that it's part of the U.S. heritage for a lot of people, whereas I think England has that. And I've always wondered if the audiences feel differently a little bit about some of those kind of issues.
I think the war in this book is probably, yes, there's that, but then you've got things like Vietnam vets and stuff.
Right. But it's not on your home soil, so it's a little bit different.
No, but a pandemic has been, and in a strange way, this play, I think actually probably it did go down quite well because we'd just come out of a pandemic.
So right.
I think the audience in Utah could absolutely, probably everywhere now, can probably relate to this idea of an event that has affected everybody and they've slightly come out dazed.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, that's a really good point.
I think also it's a piece, you know, I think the sort of piece deals with division and divisiveness. Mm-hmm. This account is doing a very good job of dividing the community. And that I think is sort of very relevant now.
Yes.
Anywhere.
Yeah.
You know, and I think the main emotional thread is a boy, Peter, doing something very courageous against the mob.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Again, also a very contemporary and resonant theme. Mm-hmm. I think that is probably one of the things that primarily attracted us to adapting the book. So I think as Nancy said, I think it's those are the themes that people tend to respond to in the UK. And I saw it in Hale Center, and I think they responded to exactly the same things through a slightly different prism.
Yeah. Well, the book obviously has a lot of universal themes that have made the book such a success.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think what she implies, and that we pushed a bit further because it was interesting to us and it's now become kind of sadly very relevant, which is this idea of, you know, the second is that the community feels that that they were promised something, that the boy, in telling them that they have to let go of the elephant and try to send her back, they feel they're being denied something.
Mm-hmm.
They're entitled to. And so it's a really strong moment of a community having to recognize they have to sacrifice something for the greater good, for their own humanity. And I think we both felt that was a moment that the world really, a message the world really needs now. And she doesn't, it's not in a preachy way, but it is so hard to stand up to a mob. And it takes a small boy to do it in this story.
I think something that a lot of people can relate to. And it's just something that, I think we've kind of forget that Kate has written more than just The Magician's Elephant. She's written several very successful books that make her one of the best writers in this genre, really.
She's incredible. And she's so brave, I think, in what she's willing to take on. And she sort of made us have to be braver because she doesn't actually shy away from things like death in a mm-hmm. children's book, but she manages to also bring magic, possibility, humanity. It's like, wow, how do you do that? And so we were like, well, this is perfect for a musical. And also Mark wrote a beautiful song called So What If Your Dreams Come True. It's like, would you say it's the 11 o'clock number, Mark? How would you describe that?
Yeah, I think it's the 11 o'clock number.
And it's kind of about going, so what if you get everything you think you want? Mm-hmm. Do you think that's going to make you a better human being? And so it sort of reverses this idea of the I Have a Dream song in the musicals. It's like, actually, sometimes our dreams can be selfish.
A fortune teller told me an elephant would lead me to my sister. Don't you think I want that? I would give anything to see my sister, but this elephant is going to die if she doesn't go home. And my dreams are not worth that. The things I want are not worth her dying for. Don't you see? What good are dreams if they trample on another's? What good are hopes if they take another's hope away? What kind of tomorrow hurts the friends we made today? What use is power if it only makes us hungry? What good are riches if we've nothing else to live for? What kind of success always leaves us wanting more? So what if your dreams come true? What will that do for you?
What about my hopes? Don't they matter?
What about my wish for something new?
Why is it so wrong to want something better?
Not the same old gray, but skies of blue.
I want to be greater than I've ever been. For once, to be noticed, really seen. What's wrong with that?
What's wrong with that?
What's wrong with that, I say?
Nothing, except when it takes another's happiness away. What kind of freedom keeps another captive? What kind of love is born from hate? How can tomorrow be better than today if it takes our soul away? What good's a family that breaks another family? What good's a playground if we won't let others play? What
kind of tomorrow repeats the wrongs of yesterday.
So what if your dreams come true? If they take all the good from you?
After all the sorrow we've all been through, how can we do this to another?
I lost my son in the war. How can I take a child from her mother?
A boat cannot sail to the people we've lost. Money won't take away the pain.
An animal dying for the things I can't have.
We're lost, can never be again.
What good are dreams if they trample on another's? What good are hopes if they take another's hope away? What kind of tomorrow hurts the friends we've made today?
Dreams come true.
What if your dreams come
true? What good are they supposed to do?
If you performed the magic once, you could do it again.
No, don't you understand? I cannot send her back. She's the finest magic I've ever performed. My whole life has been an humiliating failure. I just wanted to do one extraordinary thing.
But perhaps you do not understand. I was crushed.
I intended only
crushed by an elephant
to present Madame with
crushed ladies. Crushed by an elephant!
Please, stop this! I beg you, stop! Speak words that matter.
What good is greatness that's built on someone's sadness? What good is fame if it comes from fear? Lying is a bad thing, but it doesn't always come from badness.
What you've said about Kate is really what makes any author in that genre successful, is that they're not afraid to tackle those kinds of issues of death and loss and grief. Because if, as you said at the beginning of the show, you don't want it to be nothing but saccharine stuff, because it has to have a broad appeal. And to make it a successful musical, it has to appeal to multiple generations. It has to appeal to adults and children and young adults and grandparents and, you know, and I'm imagining that in both at RSC and in Utah, that every generation of the audience enjoyed the show and got something out of the show. You know, it appeals to people.
And I would say, you know, that the book is sort of saying that, as Nancy was sort of saying, that kind of a society really flourishes when it takes care of its most vulnerable members. You know, in this case, human or animal. But it never does it in a saccharine way. It gets there through never backing away from sort of some of the darker impulses in humans. And that's what I think we both loved about it. And actually, it was also I thought of something in relation to your earlier question as well. Something very specific in the piece is that you have a count, and there's a song called The Count Who Doesn't Count. And it's when Peter's sister, who also does something very courageous and manages to trick the count into freeing the elephant. I did suspect that an American audience might not get that, simply because you don't have a tradition of royalty. Mm-hmm. Probably quite naive on my part, perhaps even more than the UK audience.
But I think it's interesting. I think it's interesting because these days, I think maybe several decades ago that may have been true, but these days, because media has become so fragmented, people now have access to so much international television. We see so much British and, you know, international TV now. Believe me, they have all watched The Crown. They have all watched Downton Abbey. They have all watched all those shows. It's true. They, you know, they see so much streaming content that they're so well versed in, you know, UK related material that they do understand royalty much more than they used to. They really do. It's amazing. You know, I can mention things like Dairy Girls to people, and they know the show. they've all watched it here in the US, you know?
Yeah.
It's amazing. Yeah. And I love that. I love the fact that television is now international. It just is. There's not as much cultural divide as there used to be.
No, there definitely isn't. And I think, you know, and also there's kind of, I mean, we couldn't get away from things, comparisons, because there's a Royal Shakespeare Company to things like Matilda. And Adele has a song called Adele the Brave.
Mm-hmm.
That is very, like, you know, people really loved that, even though it's very different. It's in the tradition of, like, a young girl kind of imagining all the brave things she would do if she was just allowed to do them. And then she actually is really brave. And even though we had to keep her a little bit of a secret to the second act, mm-hmm. but then she becomes a very big part of the second act. So that was a lot of fun.
Yeah. So talk about the cast recording, because how did the cast recording come about? Because as you mentioned at the beginning, this is a cast recording of the Hale Center cast. Which is out of Utah, out of Sandy, Utah. Talk about how the cast recording happened.
Well, Nancy and I were firstly very keen to do a cast recording
mm-hmm.
because I think musicals need cast recordings. And we didn't get one from the Royal Shakespeare Company. And I think that was in large part due to the pandemic. We did a live recording, which is actually quite good. But we didn't go into a studio and do an official cast recording.
Mm-hmm.
So we were keen to correct that. And the show, which is picked up by Music Theatre International,
mm-hmm.
When we spoke to Music Theatre International, they were on board with that. So they gave us a budget because we certainly couldn't have, we wouldn't even a very successful crowdfunding campaign would have made it tricky to fund, given the scale of the show.
Mm-hmm.
So it was Music Theatre International that gave us the budget to do that. And we cast from, because there are several casts at the Hale Center, so we chose performers from different casts. It wasn't all one cast. And then it was done, actually quite, a lot of it was done remotely. So I had to go through all the scores and make sure that all the tempos were absolutely what I wanted them to be. So they went on those tempos. They recorded the orchestral score first. It's pretty orchestral sounding, as I think you.
Oh, absolutely! Yeah. Yes, absolutely. It sounds gorgeous. It's beautifully done.
Thank you. And I did a bit of new orchestrating for it for the recording as well. And they were great. We also, because they were up for finding us unusual instruments, like there's a crystal bachet and a theremin, and sometimes people a bit more resistant to that sort of stuff and
mm-hmm.
consider it gimmicky. But actually, I consider it a really crucial part of the texture, especially right. as a show that's exploring the nature of magic. You want more of those ethereal elements as well. And then we recorded the singers, and they did, I think they recorded it over several weeks. Nancy and I were giving feedback and asking for tweaks and changes. And it took several months, I think, the whole thing. It was a beast.
Yeah. and you also very wisely included, just enough dialogue from the script, the spoken dialogue, to help with so listeners have an understanding of the characters and some of the plot that's happening, which is important for a recording like this, because not everybody would have had a chance to see the production at Hale Center, and they can understand the story better.
It's tricky to get the balance right, but Nancy and I were very keen to give people a sense of the scope of the piece.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think it's actually almost all there. Like, you kind of get, it's like, obviously there's more in the book, but I've had friends listen to it and they're like, you really can see and visualize the show in your head as you're listening to it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we wanted, because what we want people to listen and go, oh, we'd love to do this show.
Right.
And also, so I think it felt, and also because it was so sung through as a musical piece, some of the songs just wouldn't have made sense if we hadn't done a little bit of dialogue before and after, so that people understand what's kind of happening around them, really, and where they're coming from.
And let's be honest here. The deal for a cast recording like this is it helps encourage future productions of the show. You know, and as you said, it's available through Music Theatre International for licensing. And it really helps to have a cast recording out there so that theaters around the world and around the country can hear the score and they can get a sense for what the show is about and what it entails and the size of the cast and what the orchestrations sound like. And it will encourage them to do productions of it. And this show is ideal. I mean, this show is ideal for, you know, universities, high schools, for regional theaters, community theaters. It's, you know, it's got a very broad base of theaters that could do this, right?
Yeah. And I think you made a really interesting point. The two elephants in the two major professional productions so far have been completely different. And, you know, there's a world and we've seen some amateur productions here too, where you don't need a huge, what you need is a really great cast and it's a big cast size, but actually the show can be done quite simply and imaginatively. And that was something the first elephant we saw was made of cardboard and we were both in tears. It was like a puppet. Mervyn Miller, who was a brilliant puppeteer in the UK, he literally made an elephant out of cardboard. And it was so beautiful how they moved it, how they moved the trunk, that in a way you're kind of like, well, that's it. You know, it's just about the specificity, the detail and the imagination.
Right. The whole show is really based in imagination anyway. I mean, it's a fairy tale village in a fairy tale country in a non-specific time period. And it's all about magic and dreams and loss and emotion. And, you know, so having a non-realistic elephant really doesn't matter for this show, you know?
And, you know, I'm thinking about the book as well. One of the things that Mark and I loved, one of the strands we really loved in the book, is there's a noblewoman whose legs get crushed when the elephant comes through the roof and she can't walk. And she's in this kind of state of shock and she just keeps saying she was crushed by an elephant. And, you know, this lent itself to music. But there's no happy ending. They can't undo the fact that she can't walk. That can't ever be changed. And I thought that was such a brave thing on the part of Kate to put into the book, that like there are certain things that happen to us that we can't undo, but we can. She finds a new, different life. And, you know, there's so many uplifting things in that, but it's never a lie. And I think Mark's music also really reflects that too.
So since we're kind of going down that path, what do you feel are the real takeaways for an audience when they see the show, in terms of, you know, what do you want them to get out of seeing The Magician's Elephant? What do you hope that they feel when they walk out of the theater? What do you want them to be thinking about? You know, what those kinds of things. What was the big takeaway from the show? That she's pointing at Mark. Mark gets to know this one first.
Mark, okay.
I think like there are a number of things. I think like I probably hinted at two of the things I think are really important, which is that we often feel powerless and hopeless. And one of the really important things in the show is that actually it's the people with the least power who make the most change through their small acts of courage. It's the children actually in the show that do it, Peter and Adele. So I feel like that's probably front and center for me in terms of what I would like people to go away and think about or feel. And also that, you know, the way that we treat the most vulnerable members of our society is what defines us, and societies only really flourish when we do.
Well, I think that's really beautiful. I also think within it is this idea that magic is actually there all the time around us, but that we often don't notice it, that nature is magic, that an elephant is magic, you know, the idea of something so beautiful and a huge animal. And that, you know, there's this moment at the end where it snows. We don't get a lot of snow in Europe. We get a lot of rain and, you know, but that actually a rain and snow and things like that can be a form of magic. And I think that's something it sounds twee, but it's actually quite moving when you think about it.
So what is next for both of you? Nancy, I know that I'm assuming you are finished up where they're just about to launch the premiere of series 3 of The Dry. Is that correct?
Yes. Yeah. Have you seen The Dry?
I have not. I don't know. Is it available here in the US on BritBox? I don't know if it's on BritBox or Acorn over here.
it was available on AMC Plus, and now it's, I think we're in a transition, so they're going to do the next few seasons on a different, I don't know where yet. So
okay, because I have BritBox and Acorn, but I don't have AMC Plus.
I'd get it on Acorn. There was loads of people signing up for free trials.
Ah.
It's somewhere out there, but
okay. I'll try and find it.
It's worth finding. It's an absolutely incredible show.
No, it sounds like my kind of show. I read up on it, and I know series 3 is coming. Has it premiered in the UK yet?
It's not. No, we're next month. So okay. Yes, in the thick of it, and that is the next thing that I am doing, and then I'm going to write a play.
Oh,
but I haven't begun yet. So,
and it doesn't have any elephants in it, I assume.
Not yet, but you never know. I've got a taste for elephants now, so maybe I'll just stick them in.
Okay, and Mark, what is up for you?
I saw a great cartoon in New York in which an elephant is sitting on a therapist chair saying, "No one ever wants to talk about me." next for me, I'm currently working on a science fiction adaptation. It's a musical of Pinocchio. It's very, very loosely inspired by Pinocchio. It's not a faithful adaptation of the story, and it sort of addresses AI. And so Pinocchio is the first AI child.
Oh, interesting.
So I'm quite far advanced with that and hoping that it will be out probably not this year, but sometime next in London.
Terrific. Wonderful. Well, congratulations again on the cast recording of The Magician's Elephant. It's available on Center Stage Records. I will include a link here on the website for people to get directly to Center Stage Records. Do you guys have, I know Mark has a website because I found Mark's website, so I will include a link to Mark's website so people can keep track of what he's doing. Nancy, do you have a website? I don't know if I found one.
Don't. My Instagram handle is Nancy Fallon Harris.
Okay.
But that's it. So if people are interested, they can follow me there. But no, I'm kind of a social media Luddite, probably.
But we will direct people to try and find The Dry.
You do.
Which is about to premiere.
They like Dairy Girls. It's got nothing like Dairy Girls, but, you know, it's Irish.
It's Irish. And series 3 is about to premiere. And it's the final series. Is that right?
Final series. It's got Ciarán Hinds, Oscar-nominated actor, mm-hmm. and Roisin Gallagher, who's currently in How to Get to Heaven from Belfast. A really great cast.
Yes, it looks wonderful. And I'm going to try and track it down over here so I can watch it. Anyway, thank you guys so much for taking the time to chat with me today.
Hey, Donald, I really enjoyed
it. So much, Donald, yeah.
You're all chained up. How can I follow you when you can barely move? You can't lead me to anything.
In the dead of the night, while the whole world's in slumber, what is it you dream of? What is it you wonder? Do you have a mother far across the sea, longing for her baby, wondering where she must be? Alone here with no family, under lock and key. In so many ways, you're a lot like me. A lot like me. A sister, someone you can tease, someone you belong to, someone who you please. Do you have a home? Do you have a name? I look into your eyes and all I see is pain. Alone here with no family, under lock and key. In so many ways, you're a lot like me. A lot like me. I've lived my whole life not
not knowing for sure if someone's out there for me, if there's something more. Surrounded by people who never stop to see the lonely boy before them, the boy that is me. I thought you could help me, you'd somehow lead me through. But now I see you chained here, I think I must help you. But now I see you chained here, I know I have to help you.